Well, it's been a pleasure to be here. It's a little intimidating to stand up here in front of so many people, but I've enjoyed being here, and I hope together we receive further blessing. Turn to number 990. We're going to sing verses 1 and 3. This is where the title of this talk comes from. The end of verse 3, through the church the song goes on. Verses 1 and 3.
Oh, holy God, we praise thy name, Lord above, we bow before thee,
the church, the song goes on. What is the song? Well, literally, I think this is referring to a song that is being sung in every waking hour somewhere. God's people, the church, are singing praises to God. But I'm going to use it somewhat metaphorically, use this word song to represent the whole body of hymns which has come down from past centuries. Through the church, the song continues. Some parts of this song are forgotten, have been dropped from use. But new stanzas are written. In fact, and this is a quote, every generation must add its own stanza to the great hymn of the church. And I'm not sure where I got that quote. If somebody knows who authored that quote, I wouldn't mind knowing. And we're singing from one compilation of this great song, the Christian Hymnary. This is one set of that great group of songs. And you'll notice at the top of the songs, like Brother John noted last evening, there's information. And on the left side is information about the words. This text is based on the Te Deum, I think is how you say it, which was a Latin prose writing that was then metered. I think we get it from the German, so it came from Latin to German to English. It says late 4th century, which is a long time ago. And if we include the Psalms, the Psalms in our Bible, which we sing metered, our song's history covers 3 millennia. Now, for sake of time, we're going to look primarily at the music this evening. Last evening, I was glad we had the balance of last evening with the words, so this evening I'm going to cover the music. And most of our time will be spent singing. At least I hope I can keep it that way, more singing than talking. But I'm going to make some commentary in between, and we're going to see the progression of this song, the evolution of this song over the centuries. to give a little bit of a form to our journey, consider that there are four main factors that shape hymn music. And I'm taking this from notes I made years ago, and I'm not sure if this was original with me or whether I picked this up from somewhere else. If somebody else thinks of another main factor that has shaped music, I wouldn't mind hearing it. But we have time, and we have art, and reform, and revival. And I'll try to note these as we go. Which one of those is influencing the particular song we're looking at? Words were notated or written down long before music was notated on the page. And so how songs were sung in the early church is largely unknown. But I'm guessing their music was something like, similar to the earliest notated song, which is the Gregorian chant or the plain song or plain chant, different terms for the same music. There's no good example of plain song in the Christian hymnary. I did see one. You can turn to 412 a while, and you turn one page, and it says ancient chant, 414. We're going to sing 412, but 414, ancient chant. Do you know? Can you give any more history context on it? Chant by nature is non-congregational. The music followed the natural rhythm of the words that were not necessarily metered. It had enough flex to accommodate a variety of texts, as in consecutive scripture verses. And somebody had a question about singing the Psalms. There are metered Psalms, but you can sing Psalms with, I think they call it pointing, and how, any verse you can pick up, you can get a start, and then you have a chanting, a reciting note, and then a cadence progression. And you can take any psalm and figure out the accent of the words and sing it verse by verse. I think, of course, it's in the Catholic tradition. I think it's also maybe in Anglican. So that is one way you can do it, but it's not very congregational. It was sung by a closed community of typically monks and not the whole congregation of unskilled singers. And I thought about getting a group of Anabaptist monks up here to sing a verse, but I think we'll not do that for sake of time. And how much time do I have? 45 minutes, half past? 40. Okay, I'm going to try to trim this as hard as I can. So we can sing songs that you want to sing. We're going to look at the music produced by three of the Reformations. And all three of these brought the music back to the congregation. So 412 is going to be the first song representing the Lutheran, particularly the early Lutheran chorale. Luther was the liberator of congregational hymnody. He brought the singing back to the congregation. The German chorales are much more varied than the music of other reformers, and we're going to notice that in a bit. Characteristics would be irregular meters, long and short phrase lengths, strong bass progression with the root often in the bass, which tends to make the music heavy, and feminine rhymes, which do not always translate well into English. Catherine Winkworth did a good job at translating the chorale texts into the German texts into English. This one I particularly picked because it's modal. It's based on re. You can also sing it starting on la, which maybe feels a little more comfortable. I remember Myron Souter doing this some years ago here, and surprisingly it went okay. We're going to sing verse 1 all in unison. So this is more rugged. This is early chorale music coming out of, what's the date, 1530, coming out of the Catholic chants. This would have been a folk tune that Luther, the Lutheran Church, borrowed and put to use.
Glory. Oh, Come unto me, saith God's own Son, ye heavy laden and undone, which is my burden, leave me. Ye do that helpers bring it in. I want to help you, for I can. Should all your
there's still a ruggedness to that, and the slur there at the end is sort of reminiscent of the plain chant, the Gregorian chant. Things weren't tidied up yet at this point. I thought about singing the harmony, but I think we'll let that one go and move on to something that is more tidy. Turn to number 109. We might think that one's not so congregational. It actually is fairly easy to sing once you get the tune in your head. And in a way, it's still maybe not at least not what Anabaptists are familiar with. 109 is smoothed out. Now we see art being put to task here. Time does have a way of rounding the corners on songs, but also Bach took this and gave each part somewhat of its own melody. And this song has some tremendous climaxes. How many are familiar with this song? Okay, sing it out, particularly bring out the climaxes. I'm not going to observe the fermatos particularly. At the end of the lines, there'll be like three beats. So it's basically what you have there, a half note and then a whole note and then a half. I'm going to beat it more like 2-2, but not too fast.
Oh, wake up.
Stand, and I think we'll do verse 1 again. As difficult as it is, I don't know if we want to try the words that are separated. And let's see if we can really put the crescendo into these phrases.
Oh, thank you.
may be seated. That's known as the King of Chorales, that Wake Awake for Night is Flying. And there are many Lutheran chorales in the Christian hymnary. Just look for the Lutheran names, two names and authors, composers. There are many of them in here. Next, we're going to go to Geneva, to the Genevan psalm tune. This is about 1539 to 1562. Luther and Calvin were two very different personalities. I quote, "Each left his stamp on the culture which he founded. Luther's character was powerful enough to make him many friends and many enemies. And while his friends call him vivid, courageous, and creative, his enemies prefer to call him vulgar, opportunist, and conceited. These, of course, are qualities that are interred within their bones and make no difference to historical judgments. But Calvin remains withdrawn, shadowy, a man whose life was in his writings." In Calvin's music, you can turn to number 631. Oh, wow. Calvin's music is much more stern, but more refined than Luther's, particularly the early Lutheran chorale. 631. And this one and Old Hundred, I think, are the only two in this book. And the tune Toulon, which is, some people say, a corruption of this, has the center phrase whacked out of it. Some people say it's a mutilation of Geneva 124, but that one also shows up in here a couple of times. Characteristics is two note values, quarter and half, back and forth between these two note values. Well-shaped melodies, often in an arched form, with long phrase lengths, usually eight syllables or more. The English called them Genevan jigs, apparently because they were sung a little bit fast, and with the quarter-half combination, made sort of a little bit of a energetic rhythm. So we can sing this not too slow, though we don't want to race it either. Melody on verse 1, then we'll try a harmony. And notice the smoothness of this melody compared to the early chorale tune that we sang.
Oh, Father.
Harmony, and notice the open fifth on the first and the last chords, missing the mi. Also, the timing isn't totally 4-4 consistently or 2-2 the whole way through. The last line has a little bit of variation. That was typical of the Genevan song. So this is early harmony. That the harmony isn't all smoothed out like it was. Also notice the bass has a lot of the roots in the bass, so you have a very bass that really moves around a good bit. Verse 2.
Oh,
I also wanted to say, maybe I said it in the title, the Genevan Psalm tune. Calvin Luther sang hymns. He allowed texts that were beyond the Psalms. Calvin and Geneva restricted it to Psalms, singing the Psalms. Let's sing the other one, Old Hundred, a verse of that by memory, key of G. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. So you all know this one, so you can sing it out. That tune would have had some half notes in there. When it went across the English Channel, I think it got streamlined a little bit. And we're going to go across the English Channel now to the English psalm tune. This is the Third Reformation. Henry V wanted to divorce his wife, so he broke from the Catholic Church and started the English Reformation. That's what gets blamed for it. More complicated than that. But the church in England did break from the Catholic Church, and two influences shaped the English psalm tune. First is the English ballad meter, which was 8-6-8-6, and that is now known as in hymn music as common meter. And secondly, when Bloody Mary returned to Catholicism, many of the Protestant churchmen went down to Geneva, and they brought back a love for psalm singing. So what we were just singing, they took that back to England. But attempts to fit English poetry to the Genevan tunes wasn't so successful. But the concept was. And so these new tunes written in England in common meter, long meter, and short meter started showing up. These tunes were syllabic, as were, I think, the Genevan tunes. Syllabic, that means no slurs. Each note had its syllable. These melodies were well-defined, or often were shaped around a well-defined climax. Turn to number 57. And this one gives you a little feel of what they say. Now, this is a psalm text from Psalm 1, but it's a 1940 versification. But it has a little bit of the Psalter feel. And this tune is from the Scottish Psalter. This is one of the... With the restricted meters, you could trade texts around to different tunes or tunes around to different texts. And it did tend to narrow down the number of tunes that were written. And so the same tune was used over and over again, which did lead to a little bit of a sterilization in their hymnody. But some of those were very good, well-shaped tunes. Let's sing verse 1 in unison on the melody, and then 3 and 4 in parts. And notice the symmetry in this melody. It's almost symmetrical, up to a la and levels off in the sol. Then the next line starts in sol, and we go back up to the la briefly and then come back down to the end. That song is simple and stately, and it's a song that's never out of style because it never was in style. As long as hymn books are compiled, this tune will be in use, I believe. There's a stability to a tune like this that just doesn't wear out. Now we're going to progress with the hymn tune. Now we're getting into what really makes up the core of our hymn books. The English hymn tune. This is getting up to 1970 or 1700s and beyond. This is the era of Watts. Turn to number 380, and this really has some very nice examples. It was hard to know which one to pick. Just as Watts brought new language to texts, the music begins to use a wider vocabulary. And essentially, we're seeing a development of the psalm tunes. Early psalm tunes were in unison and did not assume a harmony. They did not assume that a harmony had to be sung to this tune, whereas now we have tunes that when they're written, they assume that there's going to be a harmony to it. This is basically the psalm tune with more art applied to it. And so we start seeing a wider range in the melody. We see broader leaps, high endings to the melody, more slurs. I think except for the slurs, this song does have all those characteristics. Christ is our cornerstone, Darwall's tune. Let's sing 1 and 4.
Oh, Christ.
Next one I have here in my notes is the evangelical hymn. This would be the hymns of the Methodist. John and Charles Wesley, of course, started the Methodist Church. And they liked Handel, as I understand it. They kind of appreciated the music of Handel. A lot of the composers that came out of this revival movement sort of took some of the almost florid aspects of Handel and put it in music. Revivals tend toward exuberance and excess. And I'm a little concerned that in giving this presentation that I'm going to throw a bad light on something that's good. So an example is, "And Can It Be That I Should Gain?" Charles Wesley's text, and it has those slurs that start at the bottom and go up, and they keep building up as a motif. I don't think we're going to sing it, but a great song to sing. We're going to see after a while, particularly in the American revivals, how it can kind of go to excess. I think "And Can It Be" is a good song to sing, but that is the stamp of revivals on music. Next, we're going to look at Victorian hymns. This is an interesting set of hymns. two influences on the Victorian hymn is, number one, consumerism. More people had money to spend, so music was commissioned and produced. And whenever you do that, the quality tends to go down. And number two, as a culture who desired to listen to music, listener's culture, the music could be more difficult because the congregation was not helping. And also, listeners wanted to listen to new and different things. The music became more technique-oriented. Turn to number 122. That's the one we're going to sing. And number three, the second, the third influence is romanticism, with an emphasis on emotion rather than logic. So the classical era was logical. Now, the composers like Mendelssohn and on up through, even some of Beethoven, used more emotion. And this tended toward sentimentality. Here's a list of characteristics of Victorian music. Unison sections, and notice how this is sort of techniques, different techniques they could put into songs. Unison sections, ending songs on imperfect authentic cadences or the plagal cadence, chromatic harmony, greater use of dissonance, non-harmonic tones, repeated soprano notes with a moving harmony, and that's the song we're getting to sing illustrates that. Greater movement of the inner parts for interest. Sustained use of the dominant seventh chord. And any of the above for use for word painting, picturing the meaning of the words with the music. 122. Now, that maybe sounds negative. The Victorians have some very good tunes. This is one of them, where they took those things and very well painted the picture of the words. There is a lot of Victorian tunes that are a little bit sentimental. This one is not one of them. Fierce Rage of Tempest. I guess we'll have to sing all the verses.
Oh, Lord, O me.
We're going to stop with that verse, I'm sorry, for the sake of time. Now we're going to jump across the ocean to America. The American folk hymn, now we're talking about 1800 to 1850 when these songs show up in books, particularly if you're a Mennonite, you might know about the Harmonia Sacra. If you are from a different background, maybe Sacred Harp. Both of those books are still being used. This is the music of the country people, the mountainous people, the rural people. Rugged, energetic, muscular melodies, often pentatonic, skipping the T and the fa, which contributes to its ruggedness. Repetition in the melody, an A-A-B-A form. Often minor, sometimes modal, as in What Wondrous Love Is This, which I did want to sing a verse of, but I guess we won't. And the harmony breaks the rules quite regularly. And I'm glad we have one song in this book, 942, that goes ahead and breaks the rules so we can hear the energy of this of the American folk tune. 942, Say Now You Lowly Social Band. Let's stand to sing this one. Parallel fifths, parallel octaves, open chords, all kinds of things in here, but it does give the song an energy. Verses 1 and 2.
O Lord, O me.
Seated. We're going to finish out this last here. I think we're going to just try to do with music. Lil Mason and the New England Hymn, then into the gospel song, and I'm going to take a sequence here. We're going to start with Lil Mason, and which disliked American folk music because it was rugged and it was uncultured and it broke all the rules. So he wrote many songs. 571 is the one we're going to sing. This next flow of songs shows how good things can degenerate. Lil Mason can end up with praise songs, contemporary Christian. We're not going to go that far, but we're going to see this progression here. I guess we'll do this without too much commentary.
Oh.
Turn to number 835 for the next one. Sunday schools, camp meetings, evangelistic revival campaigns. What do you need for that? What kind of songs? You need simple songs. You need songs that the masses can sing who maybe aren't very skilled in music. And the gospel song works so well for that. It really does. 835, we're moving from Mason now to sort of the second stage, the Sunday school song and the gospel song. One Piece Like a River.
Oh,
number 19. I guess we wouldn't have to turn to this one. We could just sing it by memory. Let's do 780.
Thank you.
like to sing all of those last songs we sang occasionally. I got to wrap this up. I would say a lesson to take along with you is start with the hymn. There's two directions you can go from the hymn. The one is toward art, and some of that is good. I enjoy some of that. It keeps us brushed up on our singing skills. The other direction is toward, I'm not sure what general term to use, but the gospel song, and that more experience-oriented, simple, spontaneous type of song, and that is good. So start with a hymn, go toward those other two to ground things out. But at some point down those lines, it's good to stop. The one end goes toward contemporary Christian rock, that type of thing. The other goes toward highfalutin opera, that type of thing. Keep the hymn in the center. I was going to end up with a 21st century Mennonite song that's printed on your program, and I don't know if we're all too scared to sing it or what. It hasn't been sung yet. But my time's up. Should we sing it or not?
Sure.
Okay. There is songs being written by people in 20th century, not all of them Mennonites, but here's one that's written by a Mennonite. We sang some more this afternoon. I'm encouraged. How many verses should we sing?
Three
verses. 1, 3, and 4. Seated. I did find it interesting that we struggled a little more with the artful songs, and when we got to those gospel songs, away they went.